Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's for Women. Discover female health insurance through It's for Women.
Former state pathologist Mary Cassidy, she carried out thousands of post-mortems on murder victims over a very long career in Scotland and Ireland. She retired, I think, 6 or 7 years ago. Was it 7 years ago now?
Yeah, it must be.
And you've been very busy writing books, dancing as well. The latest crime novel is Deadly Evidence, and by the reviews, it's deadly, bleeding deadly. And she's here. Dr. Mary Cassidy, welcome to the programme.
Oh, thank you for inviting me along.
Thank you very much for elevating us. Turning to crime fiction for a second time, you must be feeling very liberated out of the stoic world of the Department of Justice since retiring.
Yeah, well, life was so serious for such a long time. Yeah. And as I say, now I'm moving into my nonsense phase. So this is all, so it's all nonsense.
I love to dwell in nonsense. It's a carefree blaze, isn't it?
It's wonderful.
Are you absolutely loving retirement?
Great. I never thought I would because I've been so invested in what I did for so long and I really loved doing what I was doing. And I never thought I'd find anything else. And unfortunately, I didn't really find anything else other than dealing with death. But I thought, well, why not try and make it fun?
Okay, that's a good solution. What was the first thing you did? Did you focus on getting fit, I believe? Was that the first focus?
Yeah, because I'd been so unfit for so long.
Were you?
Yeah, oh yeah. I mean, I spent my life driving up and down Ireland, sitting in a car, you know, sort of stuff, not doing very much, eating out of service stations. You know, life was so glamorous and wonderful.
Mind you, the service stations are brilliant these days.
I could tell you amazing. The best place to go for, you know, whatever.
I'm obsessed. I'm obsessed, but comedians are as well. Were you in labs a lot of the time? Was that most of your, were you kind of?
Well, mortuaries, yeah.
Mortuaries.
Yeah, I just went from mortuary to mortuary. Yeah, the high life, yeah.
It's the hardest job, wasn't it? The hardest job.
Well, if you know what you're doing, it's fine. But it's not everybody's cup of tea. I accept that.
Have you had time? Well, you've had time, of course, to reflect on your career now. What's your relationship with your working life now, when you look back a couple of years after retiring in the nonsense period?
I mean, I look back and think, oh, that was quite interesting. I mean, even my children said after reading my memoir, oh, I can understand why people find you interesting. And I thought, what on earth did you think I did every day?
In that memoir, and that's 5 years ago, you said to your family, you dedicated to them, this might explain all those times when I was not there.
Mm.
So you've all reckoned with that now as a family, have you?
I think they were quite happy. I wasn't there most of the time.
Don't say that. I have seen you announce in interviews that you weren't very good with children, or you think you weren't good with children.
No, I don't like. I feel uncomfortable about children. I always have done.
Well, how do you find someone who's good with children, maybe? And maybe that's a starting point.
Well, my husband's very good with them. He has to be very good with them because I would just go, here you go. There you are. I produced this. You take it off into the world and do something nice with it.
But what do you mean by it? I mean, what do you define of someone who is like going to be good with children? Present, chatting?
What? Chatting, playing with them. I mean, oh, I get the hives every time I think about it. I mean, birthdays were a nightmare. Oh, the kids said, can we have a birthday party? I'd go, oh my heavens.
They were
Halloween, I had to lock myself in the, you know, upstairs bedroom because I thought, there'll be children coming to the door. And what do you say to them? Oh God, isn't that a lovely costume? Oh no, no.
That would have done. Were you shy then?
Oh, I'm terribly shy. Yes.
Really?
Oh yeah, I'm terribly shy. But I was not good with children and, you know, I talk to them as if they're small adults, and that's the only way I can cope with them.
That's everyone, even though children love me, talk to as though they're adults, and they'll give you great out crack back. But we assume scientists, because certainty is in the field, that you'd be very confident people.
Oh no, we're introverts. That's why we're scientists. That's why we go into labs and we hide ourselves away.
Yeah, you're not in among the. You're not the gregarious fun person at the party then.
No, no. I'm the person who stands at the door thinking, oh, dear God.
Your family relationship must have changed dramatically then since you retired and you're around all the time.
Yes, yes. Yes, that's very interesting. This, you know, this sort of work from home concept. I mean, we tried that for a short period of time when we did retire. My husband decided he would retire as well.
Oh, wow.
And I said, no. You go back to work.
You sent them back out.
This ain't working. There's only room in this house for one of us.
And they can't work from home either. It's out the door. You have two grown-up children now. What do they do?
One's a lawyer and one's a fashion buyer.
A fashion buyer?
Yeah.
The fashion, you obviously were good with children because I would assume the fashion now comes from you.
Well, that's very nice of you to say so, but yeah, that's what she always wanted to be. So yeah, so now she is and very happy with it, doing very well.
I hope it's nice to say because people commented on the fact that you turned yourself out very well on the job, which itself was kind of sexist because no one mentioned how the men were dressed at these jobs.
But you see, because my life, the job was all consuming. I mean, I didn't have like a normal weekend. Mm. So going out, terrible thing to say, but going out to a mortuary, going out to a murder scene, that was my weekend. So I would dress accordingly. And I'm out for the weekend.
Existed in your head,
yes.
But you were constantly on call. So you've moved, have you? Have you left the country?
Yeah, we're living over in London area just now because the kids moved over there. So I wanted to be near them for a short period of time until they got fed up with me and sent me back.
So that's quite a dramatic, retiring and then leaving the country that's been your home for a very long time. Nothing fazes you.
No, I mean, I don't look back. I always look forward and I always think, well, let's see what's going to happen next.
You met your husband, Philip, when you were teenagers.
Yeah.
He knew the days, didn't he, when you needed to be left on your own or that you'd be up for the chat coming in from whatever job, horrendous job you were doing that day.
Yeah. I mean, the thing was, living in Ireland, everybody wants to know everything. And so he knew because he's the biggest gossip out. So he knew if I told him anything, he couldn't keep it to himself. So he deliberately would stay out my way, give me a cup of tea, plonk me in front of Coronation Street or something. And then when I got that out of my system, then we'd have a normal chat, not about, oh, and how was your day at the office, dear? Kind of thing. You
that
know?
Would never be the question. It was pretty bad. Do you still have phone call phobia from your job as well?
Oh, yeah, constantly. Because it was never, people didn't phone to say, oh, hello, how are you doing? It was, hello, we've a body or we've got something. Yeah. Can you come out? So it was never happy. And so every time the phone would ring, I would think, oh, no, something awful's happened. And because of that, then you were just constantly on alert. Because you had to have it with you 24/7.
I'd imagine because it would have been a member of An Garda Síochána giving you the call. Would they get straight to the point or would they be...
No. Oh, for goodness sake, this is Ireland. Oh, no, we'd be around and I'd be going, just tell me what you want, where you want me to be, what time, and I will be there. I don't even need to know the circumstances. I'd prefer you didn't tell me. Just tell me where to go.
There was small talk before.
Yeah, I wasn't good at small talk. No.
But I can imagine the feeling of, you know, you're ringing someone on a weekend. It's horrible news. You're going to try and dance around a little, aren't you?
I know. And I used to feel bad sometimes, you know, thinking when I come off, I go, oh, dear God, I shouldn't have been quite so abrupt. But I thought, look, this is a job. Just get on with it.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Just get on with it.
I can see you holding the phone away from your ear for a minute and a half, thinking, you know, maybe I'll tune in when they're finished talking about the match.
I know, exactly.
And you still have that phone call phobia if it goes off? I can understand why.
But I hide it now. I hide the phone away. And people then think I'm ignoring everybody. But it's just because for so long it's been strapped to me. And now I can just put it down and walk away. So freeing. Wonderful.
Oh my God, we should
on silent.
That's confidence now. That's the confidence. And Camille, obviously there would have been a lot to unload in your career psychologically. Have you done that with this character, Dr. Terry O'Brien, in the books?
Well, I think she's my alter ego. I think she's the person I would have loved to have been.
Really?
That sassy person who doesn't take any nonsense from people and who gets involved in everything that they shouldn't get involved in.
Definitely, you'd have been out of the Department of Justice if you'd done any
of that. Oh, good heavens, yes.
And for people who haven't read the first one, Dr. Terry is a Scot who moves to Ireland.
Isn't that strange?
Well, they say, you're not hiding it.
Write about what you know, and I don't know anything else.
Last time she was tracking down a serial killer, and this time it's a gangland killing.
Yeah.
Well, set the scene for us, Dr.
Well,
Mary.
Yeah. She's come back. She's obviously had a little rest away because of things were very fraught when we last met her.
It's putting it nicely.
And she's quite surprised that she gets a phone call to say, would you like to come back? And she comes back, but now the roles has slightly changed and she's now getting involved in cold cases as well as the normal cut and thrust of the what's happening now. And she gets called out to the death of a Garda. Garda's been shot. And the assumption is that this is a gangland killing.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of spirals from there. But then she starts to... She's involved in investigating some other cases, and she starts to see some links that perhaps other people haven't noticed before, and she starts to think maybe this is something that something else.
The patterns.
And so she sees the patterns. And that's what, as pathologists, that's all we ever look for, are patterns. And so she starts to see patterns where other people don't see patterns. And so she starts to go off on her own, again, in her own little investigation and pays no heed to anybody.
Did you have fun writing this?
It's great fun. It's so freeing because, you know, as I say, I can say things and do things that I always had to be very careful, you know, to keep it buttoned most of the time.
But uniquely for us as a reader, it's just that the fact that you come directly from this world. And Adele Coffey, in her review on Instagram, she said, "The detail from the forensics to the courtroom is clearly from someone who's lived the experience of working in this world, gives the reader a rich and rewarding reading experience." Because, you know, because presumably you from time to time helped crime fiction writers on their research.
All the time.
Did you?
Yeah.
Even when you were working?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, because people now want to be accurate when they're, you know,
for sure,
when they're trying to paint a picture. But what does happen is that they shy away from the gory details. And death is not pleasant. And violent death is pretty horrendous. And I thought, you know, if you want to know about it, I'll tell you about it. I'll tell you what it's really like.
What was the most common kind of mistake that they would make or consider that you could correct a crime writer on?
Well, they don't make mistakes. It's just that they gloss over a lot of it.
Oh, okay.
And that's perfectly fine. I mean, that's you don't want to dwell on it too much.
I know.
And a lot of the readers don't want to dwell on it too much. But unfortunately, that was the life I had. And so I thought, if you want to read about crime and murder, I'll tell you the real story.
There was no more gritty crime drama than Taggart.
Oh, yeah.
And you were a consultant on it.
Yeah, because they used to, when I was back working in Glasgow, they used to film the mortuary scenes in our mortuary.
Are you serious? You
wouldn't be allowed to do that.
That's
these
insane. That is really.
We'd give the place a wee wash down and the cameras would come rushing in and then they would film their scenes.
And then they would leave and you'd go back to
work. Yeah.
Wow. That's
different,
realism.
Different times. It was different times.
It ran for 27 years, I was looking up.
Yeah.
Extraordinary.
Yeah.
And
because he didn't last the 27 years.
No.
But he did end up in our mortuary. God bless him. I don't think he ever saw that coming.
Can't remember the actors now. I think he died about in 1994 was the year.
Yeah.
You've got a wicked sense of humour about you. How long did you work actually in Glasgow as a pathologist before you came to Ireland?
Oh gosh, I was there from 85. This is how old I am. From 85 to 98. We moved over, so.
Oh yeah, okay. And
so
came here.
I was there for a while.
You were there for a long time.
Yeah, so about 13 years under my belt by the time I came here.
Were there differences you noticed in the way things worked, or even the way crime scenes were in the Glasgow versus around Ireland?
Yeah, I think there was in those days. Everything's now very slick and everybody, you know, sticks to the rules. But Ireland was still a very small parochial place at that time. Yeah. I mean, to be fair, Jack Harbison was a state pathologist then. He was covering the whole country on his own.
Extraordinary.
I mean, good Lord, the man had no life at all. Well, he had the life that he had, which was going from crime scene to crime scene.
Yeah.
So everything was kind of cosy in that, you know, that we didn't have to have the strict protocols probably that we do have to have today. And so when I came over and I was saying, I need to sign this, and I was going, oh, for goodness sake, tell her to settle down. You know, everything will be fine, you know. Would I lie to your doctor? And I would go, yeah, well.
But that was the difference between Scottish system and the system here.
Yeah, it was very rigorous. I mean, I thought probably the Protestant ethic in Glasgow, you know, we do everything by the book. And then I came over here and it was a bit easy-ozy. I mean, I remember going to my first call out and I arrived probably about 11 o'clock at night and there was a guard at the door and I said, oh, I'm Dr. Casti, I've come because there's a body in there. And he went, oh, they've all gone home. Come back in the morning. And I went, what? What? What kind of country is this?
Oh, my Lord.
And then I go,
way home there now and come back in tomorrow.
And that
is
exactly
an act of crime scene.
So I thought, I'm going to see the commissioner about this. And he went, why would you want to be out in the middle of the night? And I went, that's not, probably, yes, you're probably quite right.
Murder does happen, unfortunately, but, you know, it's like an election count. Ah, we'll start at 9 a.m. after the
exactly.
cup of tea.
Exactly.
Did you sharpen things up?
I didn't personally, but I don't know. You sort of, prod people a little bit, you know.
Sounds like you might have. One of the big shocks to you probably was becoming well known in Ireland, which wouldn't have been the case in Scotland, is that?
Oh, no. Nobody
no
would
famous have, pathologist there.
No. Nobody knew who you were or what you were unless you'd actually been on the sharp end. So nobody really cared because Glasgow's a very violent place. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, it still is. The murder rate was quite high. So people didn't want to really know. You know, they would pick up the paper in the morning and go, oh, right, you know, let's go into something. Let's go to the sports pages. So nobody really wanted to hear about it.
Wasn't quite front page news like it is in Ireland.
Yes.
And did you found differences with the press treatment as well, didn't you? That they were almost there before you.
Yeah.
In Ireland. But that never was the case in Scotland.
Never. And that was why I was used to going out, you know, in the middle of the night, because the police wanted everything sorted out before the press got wind of it. So we'd be ferrying about, you know, at 2 and 3 in the morning, you know, sort of getting things done and everything, you know, body moved to the mortuary, everything all sorted out by the time, right, you know, the Daily Record rocked up in the morning. So that was completely different. In Ireland, it was the press were there and then we rocked up. And I would think, this is a bit odd.
Which meant that you had to do a kind of a media walk. Were you ever aware that there was a camera off somewhere?
I think in the early days, yeah, it was just thought, this is very odd, it's very intrusive. But then you just forgot about it. I mean, and to be fair, that everybody's just doing their job.
Yeah. And you say that you would know within minutes in most cases what has gone on.
Yeah.
You spot the pattern straight away.
Well, exactly. If you've been doing it for so long, you get pretty good at it. So you get to know exactly what you're looking at.
As a novelist now, are there moments in reality where you're turning around to a detective and stunning them with something they haven't guessed or spotted, and they think, oh, this is one, the incident has gone this way, and you turn around and go, no, it happened like this?
It does happen sometimes, you know. But I mean, I think the greatest thing that we do as forensic pathologists is go out and say, oh, this is something you don't have to worry about.
I see.
I mean, it's usually pretty obvious when there is something very serious going on, but we can go in and diffuse the situation pretty quickly. So I think that's where we earn our money, really, is by doing that. I mean, anybody can count holes, you know, sort of go, yes, he's been shot 24 times. Yes. We all knew that. I'm the only one that's going to be able to go in and pick out the bullets. But, you know, it's I'm not telling you something you don't know.
No, absolutely.
But a lot of the time it was the walking in when they've thought, is it, isn't it? And you could go in and go, it's fine. You'll be okay with this one.
Okay, you can rule that thing out of your head, sort of thing. Wow. Okay, they're the patterns you're looking for. Were there differences, by the way, in the patterns of murders in Scotland compared to Ireland?
No, unfortunately, violence is violence. And what I saw was there was a lot more stabbings in Glasgow.
Right.
Stab City. So, sorry, Limerick.
In that period.
Yeah. In the time I was there, and then guns started to move in. By the time I'd come over to Ireland, guns, you know, shootings were probably quite common. And we were seeing a lot more of that. So that was a slight change in the type of cases I was dealing with.
And those media nicknames are very harmful to places and very unfair, aren't they? I think you've mentioned somewhere that Irish killers would tend to conceal the scene more than you had seen in Scotland, is that?
Yeah, that was a strange thing, because in Scotland everything's pretty brutal, but it's all out in the open, you know, no finesse. Whereas in Ireland, you know, or like over here, they're a bit cunning. So
isn't that extraordinary?
If we just put the body here, if we just put something on top of it, nobody will notice for a while.
Wow.
So there was a lot more concealed bodies than I'd had before. Which
more concealing,
odd.
Which would concealing. Be. Chime with the shame in the moment, even though they've carried out this despicable crime.
Yeah, I'm not a psychologist, but yeah, there's something in the psyche that, you know, out of sight, out of mind, maybe. I don't know. Weird.
What else do you bring to Terry O'Brien that you're very proud of as the character? So she meddles in things and she's getting involved in cases where she shouldn't.
And she's tall. She's tall. <There you go. laughs> She had to be tall.
Why is that?
Because I've always wanted to be tall.
Now we're into psychology.
Now you're into the psychology. Yeah. Well, you're just over 5 feet. You want to be tall, which is why I always wore high heels.
Uh-huh. I didn't get that option.
Oh, you could if you wore the
stretching machines weren't available. It's like, I'll have to cope with it.
The Cuban heel.
And by the way, you had that level of fame, which is kind of odd, wasn't it? These days, the role isn't quite the household name it used to be. The changes are a bigger team, is it?
Bigger team. There's more of them, because the thing about the job is that, you know, we are peripatetic. We wander about the country and we do things here and there. But the one constant thing was the pathologist who was arriving, because in the early days, it was always Jack.
Yep.
So as soon as they saw Jack Harbison arriving, John Harbison arriving, they would go, oh, must be serious.
Yes.
Then when I joined him, there was the two of us. So then it became, if it wasn't him, it was going to be me that turned up. And as soon as they saw one of us. But then as the group becomes stretched and there's more of them, then it's different people. So people don't get to see the same familiar face again. And also the investigations have changed slightly in that we would, in the early days, we would go to every scene. We would just, you know, after that strained phone call, then I would head off to wherever I had to go. Whereas now, because of the advances in forensic science, the forensic evidence is the most important thing to preserve.
Right.
And therefore, you don't want too many people tramping over a scene. And so very often then there's not a necessity for a pathologist to go out there. So you don't see a face arriving at a scene.
I see. That's the big difference. Dr. Linda Mulligan is the chief state pathologist at the moment. Mm-hmm. And I noticed it's a team of women. Dr. Mm-hmm. Sally-Ann Collis is there. Dr. Heidi Ockers.
Yep.
Yvonne McCartney is, and you have said, haven't you, that women are especially good at forensic pathology.
We're very good at it because we recognise patterns very easily, and also we're good team players. And it's all about being part of a team. And I think some of my male colleagues didn't quite appreciate that at times. And but no, women seem to have a great aptitude for it. And that's changed, because when I came into it in the early days, you know, I was the odd one out. And now it's, you know, there's probably equal numbers, you know, throughout the UK and Ireland.
We can be assured that this team of very sharp women are running it now. Are there tools, techniques available now that you might have missed out on? Has it changed much over the years? Or is it...
Unfortunately or fortunately, forensic pathology hasn't changed very much at all. I mean, our role is exactly the same as it was back to 1850, I would think. But it's the forensic science side of it that has changed dramatically, and it's changed the whole way that the team all work together. So it used to be that the forensic pathologist was the main player, because they were coming in and saying, oh, yes, they're dead and this is what's happened to them and this is what I think. And they did all the sorts of bits and pieces. But now, whereas it used to be one man and his dog, it's now hundreds of people can get involved, hundreds of different experts. But it's mainly from the forensic science. The pathologist is just the same. All we need is a knife and a pair of scissors.
Isn't that amazing? We're happy. Yeah. Having witnessed, seen so many bodies and, you know, seen so much death as a scientist, has it altered your relationship with your own mortality?
No. I mean, I think as I say, I never look back. What happened yesterday, and that's gone. And we don't know how much of a future we've got. All we can be certain of is today. And let's enjoy it.
That's your outlook.
Yeah.
You don't think about it at all?
Not really. It's going to happen. I mean, it's getting closer and closer. I just don't want it to be too painful. Please, God, don't let it be too painful. But, you know.
Extraordinary. We'll be watching out now what Dr. Terry O'Brien is thinking, because she comes into scrapes and her own life is threatened. And we'll be reading into it now, because it's you. It's your alter ego. You've confirmed it. Dr. Mary Cassidy, the text, when she appeared on the news, arriving to a scene, it was like colour TV and all of the rest of Ireland was black and white. This is Garrett Kildare. A lot of psychology going on there. I bought Mary's new book on Saturday morning. I have it tucked in the suitcase until Friday, when I'm heading on a child-free and husband-free weekend in a hotel. Stock up on chocolate face masks and wine and diving into the book. I can't wait.
Oh, plenty of wine. You'll need plenty of wine to get you through it.
I always admired this person. I always admired your attitude to your work. Later, loved the book. She always comes across so well in interviews. You do. She has empathy with the families, and I'd vote for her. And she'd run for president. Oh my God, the president. Regardless of anything. Always interesting. I've read the last two books. Currently enjoying her last. My wife and I are both reading the book on our Kindles. There are different parts of the book, so they can't discuss anything going on. Very good. This is one story. That's Mick and Cork. They can't dare not say every sound. Can you imagine the person is faster than the other person? Deadly Evidence by Dr. Mary Cassidy is published by Hachette. It's out now, and you're also going to be at the Dublin Book Festival on the 9th of November. That's a Sunday. DublinBookFestival.com for all the tickets and so on. Dr. Mary Cassidy, it's been wonderful nonsense. Thank you so much. Enjoy. And you're very welcome back. Dr. Cassidy could be the first presidential candidate with skeletons in every closet, says that message, which they love all of those kind of puns and things, don't they? Mary Cassidy is a very distinguished public servant, very honest and relatable too, says Ian. Deadly Evidence, by the way, is the name of the book. People always text us to go, what's the name of the book now? Because they're concentrating on what the person was saying.